and welcome into the Who's On Podcast, part of the Saber Podcast Network, coming to you after a Virginia loss. The seven-game win streak is over for the Cavaliers, falling to Wake Forest 16-9 at home on Saturday night on primetime on ESPN with 55,000-plus in the stands at Scott Stadium. I was going to talk a little bit of basketball because we haven't talked about basketball since the season began in earnest. Last week, Virginia picking up wins over Rider, North Carolina Central. I got the only guy that I know personally that went to both of those basketball games last week. Also went to the Wake Forest game on Saturday night. He did it all. Mike Barber, editor-in-chief at Seville right now. How you doing today, Mike?
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I can't get my fill. I love overlap season. You got basketball, you got football, you get no sleep, but it's fun. It's fun stuff.
Yeah, the rest of us were sleeping. Mike was wide awake trying to get all those North Carolina Central takeaways and
gotta have it.
But of course, we're gonna start with football. As I mentioned off the top, Virginia falling to Wake Forest 16-9 at home. First home loss of the season, and more importantly, falls to 5-1 in the ACC. And now you got this big clump of one loss teams in the ACC that we're gonna talk about a little bit later. But Mike, overall, just one big take coming off of that game, now that we've had a little bit of time to digest what happened on Saturday.
Yeah, it just really feels like the rest of the ACC has caught up to what Virginia was doing offensively. They got off to such a great start to this year, and then they put stuff on film. And it just feels like since that there's been that body of work on film for people to study, they haven't been able to counterpunch, right? Came out great. Defenses didn't know what to do with it. But now that defenses have a plan, it doesn't seem like UVA has a response, and that was certainly the case. Look, Wake Forest bottled up the run. Jamari Taylor, yeah, he ran for 98 yards. He got 43 of it on one carry. Their total offense numbers, 43 yards on that one carry and 54 on one carry by Daniel Kalen when he came in for Chandler Morris. So that's almost 100 of your yards on two plays. That's great if that also adds into having 600 yards of total offense, but that wasn't the case. So the offensive struggles are real. And I told somebody this morning, it reminds me, I'm not a big NASCAR guy, but I know sometimes they talk about, did you take enough fuel or did you take the right number of tires? Is your car going to make it to the finish the race? And it just feels like this UVA team is just trying to hold on and make it to that finish line.
Yeah, I thought a lot about this game and especially the offensive stuff. And we're going to talk about that in kind of more in depth in just a second. But I mean, worst comes to worst, you know, you lose this game by a punt return touchdown and, you know, two fumbles that lead to field goals. And, you know, so the defense had a good day out there, but, you know, you're still in this ACC race and you got two more games really left to decide your season. So it was a disappointing loss. And I know a lot of Virginia fans kind of were like, it feels like Virginia always kind of starts building you up to get everyone in the stands, get everyone at Scott Stadium, just to kind of let you down easy there, or not so easy. yeah, so it's just another one of those kind of, you know, notches in that kind of storyline for Virginia athletics as a whole. I think there is still more out there. A lot's going to come down to what's going to happen at this quarterback position coming into this week. But you know, Duke lost to UConn over the weekend. Not a great UConn team either, by the way.
Virginia not a bad Tech, UConn team though.
Not a bad. It's like, they're in the.
I think Jim Mora would be a really good off the radar candidate at Virginia Tech. Like, he's done a really good job there. And no, they're not world beaters. You're right, but don't sleep on UConn. I think Duke's not as good as maybe people thought. But yeah, Jim Mora's done a nice job up there.
Duke has a chance if everything goes right to finish the season at what, like with four losses and an ACC championship, you know? So, I mean,
it could be interesting. It certainly could be interesting. Yeah.
It's a wild ACC race. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But yeah, one big take, it's as Tony Elliott and everyone wanted to remind you, the goals are still out there. They still have a chance towards the end of the season, but they got a lot of question marks to kind of fill the gaps in before they get there. Let's talk about the UVA offense, and I guess, you know, we can't really start anywhere else, but with Chandler Morris taking that big hit, a late hit in the second quarter there, targeting, not targeting, take it for what it will. It was definitely a late hit, and, you know, they threw the flag immediately there. Just your reaction when you saw that play.
It just reminded me that I hate the sliding rule. Like the sliding rule prevents quarterbacks from getting bumps and bangs and that, but it really puts them at risk for catastrophic hits. And I've said this for years. It's you slide, and they even say, the announcers call it, is that you're giving yourself up. It's written in the rules at the point at which you're giving yourself up. Well, giving yourself up means you're prone to take a really big hit. And look, these guys are running hard. They're running fast. They're running from a distance. Yes, the rule right now, the way it's written, it's incumbent on the defense not to do that. But it's kind of like, it reminds me of like a crosswalk, right? You have the right to cross the street in a crosswalk. You should still look both ways, because if a car hits you, guess who gets hit by a car? It's you. And that's how I feel with these quarterback slides. So, that rule to me needs some tweaking, but he gave himself up. He went into the slide, took a big hit. Anything above the head or neck, you got to be careful. I think it was a really good sign that he came out for the second half in
Yeah.
street clothes. Because if you know anything about concussions, they try to keep you out of bright lights. So had he been concussed, or if that had really been the concern, I don't think they would have had him out under the stadium lights. I'm not saying they're going to go Texas Tech and lock him in a dark closet, but you know what I mean? They would have protected him somewhat. So certainly it did all start with that. And you hope, they've played some snaps without Chandler this year. I mean, he's playing with a shoulder injury, got knocked out of a game earlier. But yeah, they need him to get back on track.
Yeah, it was a really deflating moment. It was a huge crowd at Scott Stadium, but it kind of, the after the punt block from Cam Robinson and everything, kind of it had kind of been a little dead after that. And then that happens, and there was actually a really good, presence from the student section again. They were kind of chanting his name as he walked off the field. But for the next how many ever quarters, it kind of felt a little dead in there, and it kind of woke up a little bit in the fourth quarter. But yeah, I mean, losing Chandler, and especially like that, was a big, punch to the gut for Virginia.
Nobody can suck the life out of watching a football game quite like Wake Forest. I mean, I covered that. It was 0-0 through regulation with Virginia Tech. I mean, they play some games that even if your heart's in the right place, you just can't be excited about. And I think that the way Saturday night unfolded, forget the outcome, was kind of one of those games. It was a field goal battle and not a lot to cheer. Although I will say, Kalen comes in, and though he looked like me a little bit running around in the open field, he got 54 yards on that first keeper. And I thought there was really a chance, and then they settled for the field goal. I thought that was the moment that the crowd kind of was like, it's going to be one of those nights.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'll bring it up now, but I thought in this game, you don't get a touchdown off the punt block from Cam Robinson. You have to settle for a field goal. You don't get a touchdown off the Daniel Kalen 54-yard run. If they get two touchdowns right there, we're talking about a different ball game, and it doesn't matter what you do the rest of the game. That's probably enough to win it.
Absolutely. The way the defense was playing with Wake Forest's limitations. Look, one of the worst, overused cliches in sports writing is people talk about setting the tone, right? I always edit it out when I see people write it. Like, don't say. But I do feel like when they blocked that punt and then didn't get the seven, looking back on it now, we're like, okay, we knew what we were in store for the rest of the evening.
Looking at Chandler Morris, it's usually if a player, I mean, you don't want to speculate too much, but if a player goes into concussion protocol, a week is a really tight timeline. So I see this going, if it is the case, all the way up to kickoff next week. It's going to be one of those willy wony weeks, it feels like.
It's going to be interesting. Chandler Morris is one of those few guys that I think Tony Elliott has a comfort level with, that if he shows up on Thursday and is good to go, they'll do it. Right? I've been around coaches who are like, look, if you're not back by Wednesday, I can't do it. If you're not full go by Thursday. But like Chandler Morris, it feels like, look, he knows the offense. He's played enough football. Again, it all comes down to, what is he dealing with? Tony Elliott certainly implied to us in the post game that it was very precautionary. It almost felt like he was saying, like, look, we could have pushed it and brought Chandler Morris back, but we're not going to take that chance with the kid. That gives me hope that he's going to play. Again, there's so much on the line, but that can't factor into the decision. So it's,
No.
is Chandler Morris ready to go? Now, if he is, I like their chances to beat Duke and Virginia Tech. If he's not, it's a whole different podcast we're having.
Yeah, exactly. Thursday, Friday, I'm going to go ahead and predict he'll be listed as questionable on both of those injury reports, and then we'll find out Saturday for sure. That's just the way this feels like it's going to go. One of those week-long sagas. Reminds me of the Brennan Armstrong rib injury coming off the bye week against Notre Dame. It was like waiting all week, and then finally, he comes out there. He's like, yeah, he's not playing.
And a classic Robert and I post practice press conference, if I remember correctly. I think that might have been the one where he literally ran away when there was a break between questions. I don't know if you were there or recall that, but he answered one question. Then there was a pause before anyone else jumped in the scrum, and he literally ran away because I don't think he wanted to answer any more Brennan questions.
Great times with Dr. Bob. We talked about Daniel Kalen. He had the big 54-yard run, 18 for 28 on the night, 145 yards. I asked him and I asked Tony Elliott afterwards, like, does the offense change? Is the what you can call plays with change when you put Daniel Kalen in there? And they both were, kind of coy, but said no. I think it's very clear that like there are different limitations when you have Kalen going in there. Overall, looking back on it, I didn't think it was a bad night for Kalen outside of the two fumbles.
Yeah, look, I mean, the line didn't protect him. Receivers didn't get open. I didn't love all the play calling, although I did like the fact that they got into that short passing game and got him into some rhythm. He's not the runner and athlete, I don't think, that Chandler Morris is. He doesn't have the experience. They didn't take shots down the field, but I think, again, they were trying to ease him in with the short passing game. Look, the crazy thing about the situation he came into, they only needed one score. So I think they were being really careful to be like, hey, let's not give anything away. Let's not mess anything up. Let's just go get that one score. I think the dream scenario was they can get down to the 1 or 2 yard line, run a direct snap to Jamari Taylor, win the game like they did against Louisville. And then it just didn't happen. And even on that Kalen run, when he gets down to the one, God, I mean, if he finishes that run, like, this may be a very different outcome and a very different mood around the program. But I thought he was fine. I think he is limited. I think they are not going to get back to what they need offensively with him as the quarterback.
I think that the short passing game, that's a good point there because they had three big pass plays on the day, and all three of those came off of short, quick passes to either Trell Harris or Cam Courtney. Let those guys go make the play because Trell Harris is like a running back when he gets the ball in his hands. Like, go let him, make the extra plays and get the big plays for you. I thought Kalen show some potential. And I think too, like, he's been working on the offense, but he hasn't had this full amount allotment of reps. So I think a week with him, they have a chance is what I'll say with Daniel Kalen is they have a chance if he gets a full week of reps, with the first team offense. I'm not going to count them out just without Chandler Morris completely. I do think that has a big part in why Duke is a 6.5 point favorite now at home over Virginia going into this game.
Yeah, and look, there's things they can do that are going to be better for Daniel Kalen, and they were good for Chandler Morris. Cam Ross was only targeted 4 times. He only had 2 catches for 7 yards. They need to get him back to the impact player he was the first few weeks. I think Cam Ross is huge. Trell Harris over the top is huge. I love what they're doing with Cam Courtney. I thought the best sign for me in that game was Jamari Taylor was targeted 8 times out of the backfield. He had 7 catches. That was a dynamic of the offense that I thought they lost when X Brown got hurt. I thought Noah Vaughn maybe could give it, but I said they really have lost something in terms of putting defenses in conflict if they don't have a running back and go out and catch it. To see the confidence to target him 8 times, to see the production that he caught it 7 times, and I know some of them are, real short, but to have that dynamic, I think you get that. I think you get Cam Ross back involved. You keep doing what you're doing with Cam Courtney, which I do think is creative. I think there's pieces there that can make Daniel Kalen successful, but at the same time, I think those pieces could make Chandler Morris excel. And I think what you're going to need is the excel, not the just successful.
Look, they had four red zone attempts on the night. They're 3 for 4, but all three of those are field goals. They left a lot of points on the board, even with the offensive struggles that they had with Daniel Kalen in the game. Like, he got them at least into positions that they could score. I think we can transition now into just the overall offense and concerns. Like, you're there on 3rd and 2, and you call this wild play. With offensive linemen split out wide, and you had numbers, I'll give them that. Like, you had the numbers there to do something with that. But I just come back to, and it's something that I've wondered for weeks now, ever since the Louisville game. Why is the Jamari Taylor direct snap only held for like one play a game? Why is it a one play a game kind of play? It feels like that's the kind of play that you should, like, Philadelphia Eagles style, just hammer it home until they stop you. If it hasn't been stopped yet, then why are you allowing teams to not like be tested by it?
Right, and it's crazy because that play is there because Grady Brosterhouse got hurt and they
Yeah.
had to find a way to replace the Grady bunch. I think they're seeing on film, and again, this goes back to my number one concern about the offense, that defenses are now prepared a little bit better for that play. So maybe they're outsmarting themselves, saying, oh, the defense is prepared, we got to do something else. Well, give it a shot. Run that play that's been really good
Exactly.
for you, and if they stop it, okay. And yeah, that multiple bunch formation spread, it was weird. And but again, it was a sign of how the night was going. I thought Wake Forest dominated the line of scrimmage on both sides. I think Virginia went into that play in particular saying, we can't move these guys. We can't get an opening. There's no point in direct snapping to Jamari Taylor because there's going to be nowhere for him to go. Number one, that's not good enough. Like you can't do that. You have to get back to what you were and being able to run the ball. And number two, I think you have to have the confidence to show your team, hey, we believe in this. We can make it happen. Also, I think Jamari Taylor is the kind of back who can save you if it doesn't go perfectly. And I know it's tough in that situation, a short yardage, but yeah, I think they need to get back to everything that was working early. But I also think they have to find a way to adjust because defenses know what Virginia does. They have to find a way to counter that.
Looking at Des Kitchings now, because that was the name that came up immediately in the post game from all the fans tweeting and stuff. I felt like a lot of people just came out of the woodworks to kind of talk about Des Kitchings after this one. Let's look at it. First 5 games of the season, obviously they had one of the top offenses in the country, averaging over 500 yards per game, 45 points per game. Last 5 games, they're down to 316 yards per game, 21.8 points per game. Obviously, a huge drop off there, and it plays into the point you were making already is that, defenses have started to figure out what Virginia is good at, and they have started game planning for them. And that's something I don't think this coaching staff has really had to adapt to over the years because they haven't had a ton of success in a lot of different areas. And so this year, yeah, you're going to get their best game plan. You're going to get a full week of like focus on how do we take away, this, outside edge run that was not working for Virginia against Wake Forest in this game, or how do we, take away those mesh under option routes that, UVA was running to success early in the season. How do you evaluate Des Kitchings this season?
So let me tell you one thing that I think complicated the issue for Des Kitchens. I think they had that good start, 4 or 5 games. I think teams got the video, started to adjust. And at the moment at which Des Kitchens needed to respond, that's when Brady Wilson got hurt. And I think it's really hard to alter a lot of what you're doing when you have that flux in the offensive line. So I think that was a little bit, and it's not making an excuse because this happens in football, but I think timing-wise, it couldn't have been worse. I think right at the point at which Virginia needed to shake things up, they didn't feel comfortable shaking things up because the offensive line was in flux. Now you're back to quote unquote full strength, right? Boley was in, Brady was in. I think Drake was in. I don't think he's all the way back, but I think he's there. So now is the moment that we see the response. I thought the Wake game was going to be the response. I thought the Wake game was going to be where we saw some new wrinkles off of some old stuff that really put Wake Forest in conflict. And I thought Virginia was going to have a big offensive night. I thought they showed signs at Cal and I thought they were trending up. So I misread. I was completely wrong because they went the other direction. Look, Des Kitchings did a great job for 3 months getting this offense put together, all new pieces, molding it, finding the strengths, being aware of the weaknesses, and putting together something really good. He gets an A plus, I think, there. Where he's getting a failing grade now is responding to what defenses are doing once they saw this offense. Now there's still time to save it, right? You go out and play well against Duke and Virginia Tech, make it to the ACC title game. I think this is going to be a great narrative. If you struggle offensively and lose one or both of these games, then I think people are going to start talking again about, hey, Des Kitchens did a great job going into the year, didn't really deliver once the season started.
Yeah, and I think I would find it hard to believe even, I mean, look, they're 8-2 right now. Like, no one expected them to be here at this point. I was probably one of the more optimistic people I knew going into the season. I had them at 8-4. That would be a worst case scenario for Virginia at this point in the
And
season.
I was struggling to get them to 6-6 because I had them at 5-7 because I was worried about them going west in the Cal game. I
Yeah.
thought if they could go west and beat Cal, they could get to 6-6. So I w dramatically undersold this team. dramatically undersold what Des Kitching's and this offense could be. But now they're living up, for lack of a better term there, to maybe what I expected. It's just a question of, look, what's the real deal, right? Are they more like the offense that moved the ball so well against Florida State, against Louisville at times, obviously the record-setting performance against William and Mary, or are they the offense that we saw against Wake Forest that can't really block, doesn't have much pop, and can't run the football? Or is it somewhere in between? And honestly, Preston, the way the defense is playing, if it's somewhere in between, I think they're going to be okay.
That's enough. Yeah, if it's a Jekyll and Hyde season, because what were we saying for the first half of the season? Like, this defense just doesn't have it. Like, they don't have enough like to hold people from getting like 40 points or having these big pass plays, and that was the big concern. Everyone was stressing out at the first half. Now it's completely flipped, where the defense is playing among one of the better units in the ACC right now, and the offense is looking like on the other end of the spectrum there. And you're asking, can they score enough points? When the defense only gives up 9 points on the night, that's kind of the question right now. And with Des Kitching's, like, I saw a lot of good stuff in those first few games of the season. I saw some really creative play calling. Obviously, everyone will make a big point about the scripted first drive. Like, that was always looking good. That hasn't worked out for them in a few weeks now, outside the Cal game. Like, they haven't had that first scripted drive, and that was something interesting in this game. Like, did we see the scripted drive because they went unscripted with the punt block? And so that kind of throws things off a little bit. And then the second drive, maybe that was supposed to be the scripted drive, and then like it just never kind of got off.
Yeah, again, it all goes back to not scoring, I think, on that first, block punt. And heck, there was a chance there for a scoop and score, which again totally changes the way the rest of the game played. But it's a really good point of, they never got into that rhythm, and even some good things that happened might have taken them a little bit out of rhythm, like getting the short field. And look, I think that they still know what they want to be. They want to run the ball effectively on first and second down so that they are in those manageable second and thirds where they can attack and be more creative. I think a lot of this, even though it's not sexy, it's kind of boring, is if you're getting 1.9 yard per carry on first down, which is where they were at, it just sets up you to struggle the rest of the way. And look, I don't know why. Like North Carolina, they had a great defensive line, so I kind of expected them to. Wake Forest, I thought they'd be able to run the football, and so the fact that that's happening, Washington State played better defense than I thought they'd be able to against Virginia. Wake Forest did it. They have got to get back to where they can run the ball for 4 to 5 yards on first down and then cut loose. That's how this offense works.
I know, and one of the big frustrations that I was clocking it in the box the whole time last game is that second and 10 run play. You know what's coming. The defense knows it's coming. We could see, like, all right, they're stacking eight guys in the box because everyone knows it's second and 10. Des Kitching wants to run the ball here. It's not an analytically loved play. It's an odd situation there, but it kind of gets you into that situation. That's why they can't get into a rhythm right now, is the first and second down lack of success that they've had over the last how many ever games.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you asked about Kalen earlier, and it's okay. Well, Des Kitching, what's the other thing he loves? He loves tempo, right? He loves to get a play, get some yards, and get to the line. No huddle, keep them on their heels. How comfortable are they with Daniel Kalen going that same tempo? Or are they going to want to slow it down and get the play call in for him? How comfortable are they calling plays for him, right? They had all this experience and all this game planning for how they want to call it with Chandler Morris. It probably takes a little bit longer now to call that play with a different quarterback. And look, I know you have plays that they both run, and I know you have call sheets for win, but the reality is you get into a rhythm as a play caller, and hey, if we're third and six, I'm going to do this. If we're third and three, I'm going to do this. And now you have another wrinkle. Are we third and six, or are we third and three? Who's my quarterback? What do I want him to do? Can you do the tempo piece? There's a lot going on right now, I think, for that offense that they have to answer.
All right, so what does a successful offense look like next week if Chandler Morris is not available? That's kind of the question I go back to. And I think about some of the things I really liked what they did with Kalen in the game. The quick passing, if you can get more up tempo, that's even better. Quick routes, like not a lot of progressions. Like, he's a young quarterback who has not played a lot at the college level. Reminder, he redshirted last year at Nebraska, so he didn't really play there either. So this is kind of his first season playing college football. and he's a promising guy, and they liked him a lot. They targeted him specifically to come in and play this kind of understudy role to Chandler Morris for a reason. And he had a lot of excitement and hype coming out of high school too. Obviously, he just went to a school where Dylan Raiola, the number one quarterback in the country, was the starter there. But looking back at this Virginia game, I thought, yeah, quick passing game, let him get the ball out quickly to his receivers. Not a lot of reads. It's like one, like, your number one guy, or check it down. I think that's the way to go. And then you got to get a running game, obviously. That part is whether Chandler Morris is in there, or Daniel Kalen's in there, or whoever, if Mike Barber's in there, quarterback, you got to get a running game
Definitely, if Mike Barber's in there at quarterback, and you probably don't
in.
want to run your quarterback in that situation. But no, yeah, I mean, I think what you would need to see at the bare minimum from this offense is one of the things we haven't talked about. They were great in the first part of the year, time of possession, right? And that was really a huge factor in ball games. I think they need to get back to that. Running the football, time of possession. And I think if it's Kalen, you need to get Cam Ross involved with some of those short throws because he can get you. Hey, you threw the ball 4 yards, but the play went 60. I think Daniel Kalen needs that. I think you're also going to have to run Daniel Kalen. I know he's not the runner that Chandler Morris is, just to open things up. I mean, we saw it in the weeks when Chandler Morris was dealing with that shoulder where it was really painful and they were limiting how much he was running. Defenses were keying on that. They knew that that dynamic was gone. So I think you need to show you still have that dynamic, whether it's getting funky, going wildcat direct snap with Jamari Taylor, or running Kalen. I think you have to show that look. I think you have to get Cam Ross and Cam Courtney the ball short. And I think you've got to throw in that deep shot to Trell Harris just to keep people honest. I mean, there are way too many people near the line of scrimmage right now for Virginia to handle. The way to get them off is quarterback run and deep shots downfield. They've got to mix those in.
You mentioned the running style. I kind of hearken it back to like a Daniel Jones kind of running style, where it doesn't look like he's going fast, but he's got long strides. So like he makes up a lot of ground in a quick amount of time. Like that's kind of what I was thinking of, and just happens to be a Daniel comparison.
That is way more complimentary than what I said. I said he looks a little bit like when your punter gets loose on a big fake punt and he's running around out there and you're like, he's not the most athletic guy, but there's nobody near him. He can make some yards. That 54-yard run reminded me a little bit of a turkey trot. But look, no, I think they know what he can do. They can put him in those spaces. And a lot of it, Preston, is just showing the defense that it's there, that could happen. Because like I said, you've got to get some guys out of the box off this line of scrimmage.
Yeah, absolutely. I look, bottom line is, the offense is not where it has been. I know Tony Elliott said a couple of weeks ago that he still thinks that offense is in there. I think at this point it's safe to say I don't think that offense from the first five games is still in there, but there's enough certainly there that they can have a productive offense, especially with the way the defense is playing, that they can go win these last two games and at least put them in a spot to go to the ACC title game. And who knows once you get there.
Yeah, look, I think that offense is still in there. The problem is defenses know how to stop it. So what can you do with that offense to make it the offense it needs to be? Look, some of it was opponent based, right? Early in the season, Coastal Carolina has not turned out to be a very good team. William and Mary, is an FCS opponent, but some of it is just, hey, you've got to evolve as the year goes on. Again, that evolution has been stunted. Injuries on the offensive line at a critical moment. This injury to Chandler Morris, but those are excuses, right? Or those are the reality. So you have to find a way to evolve and get to the point. Look, you don't have to put up 700 yards a game, but you have to possess the football. You have to score a touchdown in a game. The first time since 2022, they had a game where they didn't score a touchdown. You can't have that. And if you do, you're not going to win an ACC title. And maybe it's that simple. Like you shouldn't win an ACC title if you don't have an offense that can score a touchdown in a game.
I think people would be fine if they're only going to put up 327 yards total offense if they could just convert some more of these red zone opportunities that they get. Like
If they
that.
score there at the end, it's just the latest chapter in the cardiac Cavs, right?
Yeah.
And everybody is ecstatic because you had a big crowd, you won again, you pulled it out. You pulled it out without your quarterback. Like it's all good news on Sunday morning if they get one touchdown in one of those drives. Never did it. You got to be better than
Instead, it's cardiac arrest.
that.
Defensively, they held Wake Forest to a season low 203 yards, only gave up 9 total points on defense. Obviously, it comes down to a punt return touchdown, which I'd love to talk about because I don't. It was weird. I think the punt, I kind of bounced obviously, and like it looked like guys maybe turned off a little bit on there. And then once you get past that first kind of line on the punt return, then you've got like the big guys that are forming the wall there, like Jameer Carter, great defensive lineman, not a great open field tackler because that's not what he's asked to do at his
Certainly
size.
not on the run.
No, it's certainly not. And then Daniel Sparks takes a bad angle there towards the end. There's a lot of bad angles overall in that punt return touchdown. Then the two lost fumbles. Virginia hadn't lost a fumble all year. They lose three in this game to help Wake Forest out. And then, the final field goal they scored was on a 9 minute plus drive where the defense just couldn't get off the field. I completely was not keeping track of time. And then Virginia gets the ball back after that. I'm like, oh shoot, like they only have like 2+ minutes left. Like it's now or never.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was crazy from the defensive standpoint was I think I have this stat right. I think Wake Forest was 2 for 12 on third down before that final drive. And then they converted four in a row, I think, on that final drive. And some of them were long. Some of them were third and six, third and sevens. That was the moment where, look, it's hard to complain about the defense. They were really, really good. No sacks, no turnovers, and gave up the third down conversions on the final drive. If they get any of those things differently, this is a different ball game too. Again, overall, the performance of the defense was not the problem, but it kind of reminds me of nobody stepped up to make a winning play, right? And that's what you need. I thought, Cam Robinson did right from the start. That's a winning play. Maybe Jamari Taylor's run there before the fumble is a winning play, but you just didn't have the winning plays. The somebody stepping up and doing something where you're like, that's going to be the lead of my game story. It didn't happen for Virginia.
You're thinking the whole time though, throughout with the way the defense was playing, I was like, okay, surely one of these times they're gonna like have that, that game-winning play like you talk about that they've done so many times this year. It just never happened, and mainly because like Wake Forest didn't need to throw the ball that much, and like when they did, like it wasn't much to write home about. But that's why I get to that last drive when they're converting all those third downs, and Robbie Ashford is just running for a first down, and that there's no quarterback spy on him. I'm like, you don't have to like double up receivers on the outside. Like this guy is not a good thrower. Like, just watch him on the run, though, because that's the only way that they're going to pick up this 3rd and 8, 3rd and 7.
Yeah, I think both coaches kind of were like, hey, man, this is just a don't mess it up kind of game, right? This is an ugly game. It's going to be low scoring. Don't mess it up. Just get the ball down the field, get it into the end zone, and you'll win. Neither offense managed to do that. And it was a very Murphy's Law night for Virginia. It's ridiculous that they had fumbled as many times as they had and not lost one. Nothing about them or their skill, or it's just not, football's not round. It bounces funky directions. Like the fact that they had, what, fumbled 10 times and lost none of them. It's weird. That's a weird statistic. Now, that statistics always come back to the mean, right? So all of a sudden, three of them go the other way, all on one night, all in a close game. Can't have that. That punt return, that's the worst possible night for it to happen, a night where neither offense can score. So a little bit of Murphy's Law, I thought, factored in. And I thought both coaches understood what was happening, right? They had a good feel for the moment. This is an ugly game. Don't do anything dumb. If you take a chance, it's going to go poorly. I thought they both approached it that way.
No, I'm glad you said Murphy's Law because that's exactly what this was. It's just like nothing was going right. And it was just kind of like, all right, can we hold on to this? And as soon as the punt return touchdown was like, okay, now this is really in dire straits here for Virginia. And that was before the fumbles and the field goals that Wake Forest was able to get after that. Let's look at the ACC race now to close out on football. UVA now one of five ACC teams with one loss in conference play. We talked about it afterwards. There's only a max of three ACC teams that could end the season with one loss because Duke and UVA obviously play each other this week. Georgia Tech and Pitt play each other, and then SMU. So at max, you can have seven and one teams at the end of the year. I think in most of those tiebreakers, all but maybe one, UVA wins out and goes if they end up at 7-1. I think there's like one that has like 50 different variants that kind of come off of it, and like this game has to go this way, and like eight of these games have to go this way. But I mean, but now what Virginia did with losing this game is you throw yourself into the ACC chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, if Virginia wins both of its last two games, it's going to be in a decent position. There's even a scenario where they're alone atop the standings, right? I mean, if Virginia wins both its games, what, Pitt beats Georgia Tech, then loses to Miami, and SMU loses to Louisville, Virginia is the regular season champion. They're the only team with one loss at the end. That's great. Now, you can have a two-way tie, right? Pitt, Georgia Tech, somebody's going to take a loss there. But again, it all comes down to what can Virginia do? There was nothing we saw Saturday night that tells me, oh yeah, this team's going to win its final two games. That's the concern. There's a lot of iterations. There's a lot of ways it can play out. I think it's important to note, and I did note this in my column, the NC State game does not count as a common opponent.
No.
Like, people keep forgetting about whether it's conference. It's a non-conference game. I think people are clear on that finally. But it also does not count as a common opponent. That is the tiebreaker that they use. They go common opponent, then common opponent by your order in the standings. And Virginia's loss to NC State won't factor in. Georgia Tech's loss to NC State will in that situation. So that's part of the reason that the ACC office hates non-conference conference games against opponents, because it muddles things. But Virginia's in really good position on all the math stuff and all the
Yeah.
iterations and all the possibilities. Where they're not in a great position is their ability to score and win.
Yeah, you got to make the math math. Like
Right.
if you get to the end of the season, you got three losses in ACC play. Well, guess what? It doesn't matter anyway. So yeah, you gotta win out. And I think we knew for a while now that this game at Duke was going to be a big one with a lot of, kind of tied to it. Now you've got Duke and Virginia, both one loss. I think ESPN Analytics said both of those teams had the second best percentage chances of getting to the ACC title game. And really, with that being said, that means like it's whoever wins this game is going to have a really good shot of finishing it out. Don't talk about the boogeyman that's waiting for Virginia at the end of the season after their bye week. That'll come in time, but obviously Durham, huge game this week for Virginia. And if you lose this one, then it's just kind of like it's over. I think that sticks a fork in the ACC title chances.
Yeah, and I've been saying for a while that there was sort of this uneasy feeling among Virginia fans that with everything going great, they could come out and roll Wake Forest, win that game. But if they lost to Duke and then Tech, this season was just going to feel like a huge letdown, right? Now, the fact that they lost to Wake, okay, how does that factor in? I mean, if you lose your final three and you lose to your rival, the fact that this is a season beyond, I think, everybody's expectations is going to be lost in the fact of how it ends. Now, conversely, if you right the ship and win these two, this is truly, a special season and something that is not just based on your win-loss record and your standings. Something really special happened with this team. It's amazing what's on the line. It's a season on the brink of it could be this great moment or it could be a real letdown, and there's really nothing in between at this point.
I think that with everything, they could still lose at Duke. And if they beat Virginia Tech, then it's still a successful season in my mind, because like no
Oh,
one
definitely
had them
successful. Yeah.
win 9 games, and I'm sure it'll be a letdown because the expectations rose to a certain point. But I always say to people, like, don't look at your expectations in week, 10, 11, 12. Look at your expectations back in August. Like, what were you thinking back then? It's that should be the judgment of like how a season is seen in the end, in my opinion.
But remember that Tony Elliott went to Charlotte and said their expectation was to compete for an ACC championship.
Yeah, but he said that every year when they're winning 3 games and 5 games,
But I don't know. I
not
don't know
as
that he's.
strongly.
Yeah, actually, I don't know that he said it like this. This was the year he came out and said, "We have the players, we have the talent, we have the depth. Our goal is to compete for an ACC title. To get there with 3 weeks to go, and not get across the finish line, I think would feel like a tremendous gut punch." Even though you're right on the arc of things, people are going to be like, "This is great." I do know some people who are still not sold on Tony Elliott, and who
Oh,
feel
for sure.
like, 8 or 9 wins, and a big contract extension that he's likely going to get could be like the worst case scenario for Virginia. You don't get your ACC title, you don't get your college football playoff spot, and you get a coach extended. Look, I think he's done a tremendous job building this roster. I think he's done a pretty good job coaching this team. I think the jury's out on how we're going to feel about it until we see what happens these next 2 weeks.
Absolutely. I think at the same time too, like just like there's people that are just not, they're never gonna like Des Kitchings in the as an offensive coordinator. They're never gonna like Tony Elliott as a head coach because of what they saw for three straight seasons, or they have their opinions based now. And I don't know, short of an undefeated season and number one seed in the college football playoff, if this year was gonna change their mind, because they have the fallback of like, well, you got a lot of money and you invest in this roster and like that you should win, six, seven, eight, nine games with that.
If Tony Elliott brings this home and lands this plane and you're not sold, that's on you. I mean, it really is, because I mean, he rebuilt this roster entirely, formed essentially a new team, got them to buy in, got them to play well. If he gets them across the finish line and you're not a believer, you're a hater, man. Like, that's just going to be you forever. And there are fans in this fan base, in Virginia Tech, and any fan base in America that will
Every
never like the offensive coordinator. And I've learned that in my 26 years as
yeah, I don't know a
fan.
lot of perfect offensive coordinators in the world.
There are none, and it's a favorite lightning rod. So, look, it all comes down to what you do on the field. We always say that. And I think things are trending in the right direction. I think Tony Elliott has showed he knows how to build a program. He knows what he's doing. A lot of players who are contributing, even though they might not be the stars, are guys they've developed to bring depth. There's a lot good to feel about. You got to bring it home. You got to land the plane.
Yeah. These last two games are going to be huge for just how this season's looked back on. All right, let's look at first two games of the season for UVA men's basketball. First two games of the Ryan Odom era, wins over Rider, North Carolina Central. This week they've got Hampton and Marshall both at home. Wild to live in a world where the home men's basketball game has moved up a couple hours because of the road football game, but that's the world we live in right now. If for fans that are enjoying the football season at least. But three early impressions for the men's basketball team. We'll each do three. Try not to overlap at all. But Mike, why don't you take the ball? Who do you? What's your first early impression of this basketball team?
Well, I think number one for me is we're seeing what they are defensively, right? We're seeing that, yes, Ryan Odom is a full court press guy. Yes, that's what he wants to do. That's what he wants to be. It's not a full court press to turn you over. It's not a full court press to create havoc like maybe we had seen at VCU with past VCU coaches. This is a full court press that's designed to make it hard to get the ball across the court and give you less time to work on in the half court. That was always sort of the knock on the pack, and Tony Bennett was right. He let you get the ball up and he forced his defense to defend the entire shot clock. Ryan Odom, in a lot of ways, wants to be a Tony Bennett defense. He just wants
Yeah.
to do it with a lot less time on the clock. So he's asking his guys to go harder up the floor so they can do less in the half court. I think that's been good. I think it keeps getting better. I think their help concepts are there. I'm very encouraged by what this defense will be, and that will be a huge part of this identity.
Yeah, like you said, like he wants the teams to work late in the shot clock, if that sounds familiar. Like he said, he told his team before the first game, like he was like, look, we got to get these teams into it later into the shot clock. From there, the fans will know what to do because that's what Virginia fans are used to. So in a lot of ways, it looks familiar in that setting. We've seen a shot clock violation or maybe two at this point in the season. So that part's at least familiar. First one for me is, I mean, let's just talk about the big Belgian, Tess DeRitter. Scores in 20 plus points in his first two games of the season. He's the first UVA player to do that since Ty Jerome back in 18-19. And it's the ways that he's doing it, because all offseason, Ryan Odom was saying like, oh, he's a bully ball guy. But in that first game, especially against Rider, he's got some pretty crazy footwork, especially in the post, that I'm like, I was a little concerned. Like, you can't always play bully ball when you get into the conference play and you're playing bigger guys and guys that can match you physically, but you can work some scoring with that, with some of that footwork out there.
Yeah, I think he's been outstanding. And does it translate to ACC play? I think that's going to be a fair question. But there's
Yeah.
nothing I've seen watching him that makes me say that won't work in the ACC. And you see that sometimes, right? Sometimes you see a guy who's 7'2" and skinny, and you're watching him muscle Rider or schools like that. And you say, okay, that's not going to translate. Nothing that Tess DeRitter is doing automatically won't translate. I think there's a chance that you're going to see him be a 20 and 10 guy in ACC play.
Yeah. Second impression for you.
To me, it's Ryan Odom's willingness to match up and mix up his rotations. We saw it in this last game here against North Carolina Central. He had a lineup at one point with both centers on the floor and both point guards on the floor, right? He has Chance Mallory and Dallin Hall. He has Dallin Hall playing off the ball. We could have a whole show on. I don't totally get that. Like, I think you have better options if you're going to play him off the ball anyway, but he's got both of them out there to give you ball handling while he's got two centers on the floor, and there are two centers that he's confident can step out and play on the perimeter. So when they do that, Ugo's at the center, and you've got Johan Grunloe is actually the four willing to step out, but it's matchup based. So if the matchups flip, Johan can go inside, Ugo can go out to the perimeter. I think, again, Tony Bennett was known for changing his starting lineup based on the opponent. I think fans are going to see with Ryan Odom, it's changing the rotations in game and doing some rotations and some bench combinations that you haven't seen before. I think it's tough to prepare. And I think, again, it's a lot of this is driven by the injury to Devin Tillis, which we should mention.
Exactly.
In fact, Dallin Hall said that. He said, look, with Tillis out, we're trying to do some other things, trying to find some other combinations. But I think Ryan's creativity to break the mold a little bit, again, who plays their two true centers and their two true point guards on the floor at the same time? I think that's been something that's jumped out here in the early games.
It's funny, going back to ACC tip-off, I asked Ryan Odom specifically about that kind of lineup with both Onyensu and Grunlow on the floor, and he was like, yeah, I don't know if we'll actually see them on the floor together, but you know, like you said, the Devin Tillis thing injury forces your hand there. And so in the first game, it was, all right, let's throw Martin Carrera out there for a little bit, a couple minutes. Let's put Sam Lewis at the four for a couple minutes and see if we can kind of get by that way. After the game, he quickly teased that, yeah, we're working on some Onyensu Grunloe kind of big lineups. And that's exactly what we saw against North Carolina Central. And it's, I think they're lineups that can work because, like you said, they believe that both those guys can stretch the floor, so it's not going to clog things up offensively. And then defensively, I think I've loved watching both of those guys play defense. I mean, gosh, Grunlow had 7 blocks in his second game as a college, you know, freshman, however you want to classify it. And on Onyensu, it feels like he's going to lead the country in blocks per minute this season because he just does a lot in those short amount of minutes. That's actually my second impression is the center position might be their best position on the roster right now with as far as starter backup, those guys playing minutes.
Yeah, I think they're really good. They're both really good rim protectors. And it's fun, Preston, because they do it a different way, right? Johan Grunloe is all about timing, technique, the way he blocks. Onyensu is the swatting, the big dramatic, send it into the sixth row. But look, both of them, yeah, I think both of them are a factor defensively. I think both of them are athletic enough where you can get pulled out to the wing and feel like, okay, we don't have to panic right now. They can do this for a minute or two. So I think they are a really good pair. Again, super interesting to see them play together, but I think long term, you're right. What's interesting there is shot blockers are going to get in foul trouble, especially Onyensu with the big arm swing. But Grunlow too, it's going to happen. You know, we saw some issues with DeRitter and Grunlow and the officials in this game, just maybe getting used to some of the way that you know, the American game is called. The fact that they have two there so that when one comes out, another guy can come in who can do the same kind of things. I think that's going to be really valuable.
All right, last impression for you.
I think my last impression is the uncertainty for me around 3-point shooting. Like, look, this is a team that everybody said Ryan Odom went out and got four guys who hit over 36% from three. I mean, he brought in shooters. And in the first game, it was really ragged. And in the second game, it was pretty good. Except they had a stretch where they missed eight in a row from three, including four on one possession, which is great to be getting the ball back, terrible to be missing that many. What's it going to be? And so that to me has jumped out. Like, look, they're unafraid to shoot the three. They've got guys who can do it. When they get going, it's great. I was a little concerned with the way they played against North Carolina Central zone. I thought they spent a lot of time swinging the ball around the arc looking for a three. They didn't really have much penetration. Now, in the second half, they were a little better. I thought Malik Thomas did a nice job penetrating. Thought they threw some balls into DeRitter. But there was definitely a stretch where I'm like, gosh, it's not that they are getting great threes. It's that they are just looking for only that. That's got to be better in ACC play. You've got to be able to penetrate. You've got to be able to get paint touches into the rim. Kick out threes are what you want, not these sort of swinging around like you're playing a little kid's game, passing the ball around the arc, and then somebody eventually shoots it.
Yeah, it's they've shot a ton of threes. That's what they said they're gonna do, and they have fully lived up to that so far, but they've also missed a ton, and especially some like good opportunities, it felt like, from good shooters. I've been surprised with Jakari White. He hit two, including a banked in three in front of the Jakarmi, which is a fun little twist in the
Very
student
cool.
section this year. But yeah, a lot of guys that you expect to hit those threes aren't hitting them right now, so I would expect maybe that evens out over time, but again, they're shooting a lot of them. You want to be making some. And if they make, I said after the first game, I was like, if they make at least 25% of those, like they're probably, up by like 30 or 40 points late in that game. And instead, it was a little bit closer. And same thing with North Carolina Central, too.
Yeah, I mean they've scored over 80 in their first two games, the first time since I think 2007 that they've done that. But man, if they knock down a bigger clip, if they're at that 38, 39, 40%, which I think they did end up there despite, which is amazing, in this last game, despite that stretch where they missed eight in a row, to still finish at 38% from three is crazy. But look, they've also missed a lot of free throws early on.
Oh my
And
gosh.
I mean, these are good shooters. Statistics don't lie when you have experienced players who've played a lot of ball. Right, freshman year, maybe it's not the same to sophomore year, but these are guys who've played two, three, some of them 4 years of basketball. Some of them have played professionally. We know what they are. Their statistics don't lie. So the number of missed threes, the number of free throws, it's jumped out early. It's an early impression. I don't think it's going to be a long-term problem.
Yeah, free throw wise, Chance Mallory was at the line late, and I was trying to look up who was the last freshman to score 10 plus points in his debut in his first two games, but then he missed the free throws, and I was like, I'm not going to bother with that anymore.
I had a line in my story about the 80-point mark and the history of the 80 part when and then he missed, and I was like, man, are they going to not get to the 80? And they did get there. But yeah, those for bettors and for sports writers, those late free throws, sometimes they matter.
All right, last one for me is Malik Thomas. I believe we'll get going. That was the one sure thing I had coming out of the preseason, those first exhibition games. Like, he was the one guy that was consistently scoring. His first game goes 1 for 10 from the field. This last one had a little bit of a cold stretch there as well. Eventually gets over doubled into double digit points this time. I think he's talented, and you see it on those drives where he's making a lot of contested layups. I don't think he's really gotten any foul calls yet this season on those contested drives. There's one in the Rider game I remember specifically where he didn't get a foul call and he
He
was
wanted
looking
it.
for it. Yeah, he wanted
Yeah.
it, didn't get it. And then the shooting, he shot a good amount of threes too, and they haven't really fallen for him at a consistent clip yet. I just think he's too talented of a player, but I think that too has played into a little bit of a herky jerky start to start the season for UVA.
Yeah, I think there's definitely no reason to panic on any of these fronts. Right. Like I said, statistically, these guys are good 3-point shooters. I think Malik Thomas is going to be one of the best scorers in the ACC. I think he's going to be the guy who can dribble penetrate to open up for the outside. But it's certainly two games in against overmatched opponents. You're like, this is a little bit weird. Look, it was interesting against Villanova in the exhibition. Virginia didn't foul much, which is important to Ryan Odom. He plays an aggressive physical style, doesn't want to get in foul trouble. Then against Ryder in the opener against a lesser opponent, they were called for a ton of fouls, and it was an issue. Then it got better again against NC Central. It's a small sample size. So, let's check back in 2, 3 weeks after Hampton, after Marshall, definitely after the Greenbrier, right? That's going to be, what is that, Northwestern and Butler? That's going to be a much better kind of gauge for where they're at. But if the threes are going to be streaky, they have to have some other things. And I think they do with DeRitter inside, and I think they do with Malik Thomas driving to the rim.
Yeah, what you want to see out of these first four games is just a little bit of improvement each game. And then when you get to Greenbrier, that's going to be the first test of like, all right, where are they exactly before you get later in the non-conference and you got a road trip to Texas, you've got Maryland and some of these other games later on in conference play. But Mike Barber, thanks for joining us. We covered a lot of ground here today, and it's a big week for UVA coming up. A couple of basketball games, and then, of course, the road trip for football down at Duke with a lot on the line. But again, thanks for always just coming on.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun when there's a lot to talk about.
Right? I kept saying, like, people wanted to talk about UVA football. I haven't been able to pay people to talk about UVA football in a
We
couple of years.
are.
That'll do it for the Who's On podcast. Of course, catch us on YouTube or on Apple, Spotify. You know where to find us. Leave a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify, and also subscribe over on YouTube. We're really picking up some steam over there, so we'd love to keep that going as we get deeper here into the football season. So again, that'll do it. We'll see you later in the week. We'll have a preview of the Duke game with Connor O'Neill from On3. So we'll stay tuned for that.